So per each hotspot, we're making generic recommendations on the types of adaptation strategies that you could pursue. A lot of this revolves around enhancing drainage and conveyance and storage capabilities, looking also at seawalls and shoreline projects, adjusting your tailwater condition and managing and designing your stormwater system to accept the fact that you're going to have sea level rise that's going to reduce downstream capacity for drainage overall.
Very interesting presentation given to the Pensacola City Council agenda review session on Monday from Aaron Dady, one of the consultants who conducted the vulnerability assessment for stormwater management and water management in general in the face of rising sea levels. And you heard her there talk about all kinds of things like, how do you get the water where it needs to go? Conveyances. How do you store the water until it can get where it needs to go? Retention ponds. And then how do you think about water outfalls into a rising water level, because you can no longer assume that you're going to be able to store it there if it can't get to there. And then, of course, we have all these areas that flood that might not normally flood but might flood because they can't get out, all of that stuff. Look at that. It's a very interesting presentation. I'm still, you know, torn on how much I really believe that, for example, sea level rise is, you know, A, happening, to what degree is it happening, how much of a threat it is. But given a lot of the weird weather that we've seen and obviously the ongoing problems with stormwater mitigation in the city of Pensacola and in our two-county area, I just thought it was an interesting assessment. Joining us now, D.C. Reeves, who is in Destin for the FPL conference. D.C., welcome back to the Pensacola Morning News, sir.
Thank you, Andrew. How are you?
I'm doing great. So just kind of, I wanted to get, you know, you guys didn't really respond much. I mean, it was her presentation, and then there was about 3 minutes of, yeah, everything goes, let's go to the meeting. But your thoughts on what she was saying in terms of, you know, what the city should be doing for improving its stormwater facilitation and solutions and, you know, resiliency?
Yeah, you know, I think we all as citizens would agree that we can do better in stormwater for our city just because of friends we know, neighbors we know, that when we have a big rain event, it affects them, and disproportionately so. And so this study is not only it gives us the information to really reinforce that in a data-based way, but it also equips us, most importantly, I believe it equips us to go address those issues, be it with grants, with other opportunities, that we're not just saying, hey, we need a grant for more stormwater because we promised that we've got a stormwater issue.
Right.
It's that now people can see it in black and white, or I guess in a better case, in red, yellow, green, and blue, those maps that are pretty alarming in some of those instances that she showed. So Cynthia Cannon and our planning office has really taken this up. This has been a year-long process to have this, to one, understand what's in front of us, but two, to have some opportunities. And you may remember from budget time, one of the things that we have to address is the stormwater assessment in the city. We have to. We right now, it should be about $120 to $140 just to keep, to maintain what we have in the city. And it's at $80 on average right now. And so we can keep doing that if we want. It just, we won't be able to clean out our stormwater ponds,
right,
and we won't be able to address what's directly in front of us. So it's nice to have something that gives us real black and white data of exactly what the issues that we have and what our biggest issues are as well.
And I thought it was also, I mean, a good note, again, if you take for granted the premise, okay, which I don't, but if you do, that sea levels are getting higher, that puts us in a different problem when it comes to storm surge. And she mentioned this, that, you know, 3 feet of storm surge against a 1 foot average below grade water level versus a 2 foot or a 3 foot or a 0 foot, those are fundamentally different things. And so areas that were not vulnerable before become vulnerable because when the water is higher, the surge affects it fundamentally in a different way, right?
Yeah, exactly. And also it gets detailed enough to give us priority areas too. It's not just, hey, here's this dilemma that's coming for the city as a whole.
Right.
It's kind of, hey, all right, if you are going to address these areas, and again, me and you have talked many times about, we're addressing one in a big way with Hollis T. Williams and all the $30 million of stormwater infrastructure we're going to be able to put there.
Right.
But it's kind of nice to have that roadmap too, you know, to say, all right, well, if we do run ourselves into a $5 million, a $10 million grant, where would we want to put it? And, you know, and it just equips us, again, moving forward to try to address the biggest priorities that we have.
I wanted to ask you about this public camping law that the state is working on that looks like it's on the verge of passing. The Senate just passed it. And I would expect the governor to sign. I think the House has passed it also, if I remember correctly. And the short version of it is, it seems like they're kind of trying to do what we did with the under I-110 encampment. The idea is the city is going to be required to move people off of private and public property if they are camping there, and then create a place where they are offering to them to be, where you can bring services and security and water and toilets and things like that. That place would not be able to be in any one place more than 1 year. But I don't know. I haven't been following this all that closely, but it seems generally like an okay thing if it's going to reduce random camping around all the places. But your thoughts, I assume you've been paying a little more attention to it.
Yeah, and you know, it's relatively, I mean, new-ish in terms of, you know, state news coming through. So,
right.
So I don't have full understanding of both chapter and verse on every part of it. But, you know, what I guess I'll answer it this way. What would I be looking at? What I'd be looking at is, what does the city's obligation become? And as you can imagine, like many things in Florida, they're often written for cities much larger than us.
Right.
In terms of needs much larger than us. And also have infrastructure and manpower much larger than us. And so that's what I'm always looking at with any legislation in Tallahassee is, how does it affect the 55,000 here and our ability to do our job? I'd have to look into all the details and say, you know, is that good? Is that not good? I certainly understand the frustration of folks being able to camp on public property. I can certainly sympathize with that, but what we'll have to do in replace of that is what I'm going to be paying close attention to. At the end of the day, these are our public spaces that we share together, and they were not built nor constructed nor intended for anyone to be able to camp there in perpetuity. That's not what they're designed for. That's what I'll really be paying close attention to is
what comes
the
out.
City of Pensacola's obligation become if this were to pass.
And by the way, that's how I read the ordinance too, is that Senator Martin and the rest of the senator basically saying, look, you can't camp on streets. They weren't built for that. You can't camp on sidewalks. They weren't built for that. You can't camp in parks, and you can't camp in, you know, trails, because they were not built for that.
Right.
But we can't keep saying that if we don't have something that is built for that, and if we don't have shelter space, let's create an outdoor area where they can do the camping on a space that's designated for that purpose, so that we can't just say no, no, no here and here, but we can actually say yes to somewhere else. And as you say, I agree. Let's see what the final product winds up being. You guys did something recently that I really like. You and I have talked before about this project in New Orleans that is kind of amazing, that is being used as maybe a pattern for developing the Baptist property, maybe on a smaller scale could be used for developing even the Malcolm Young property. I was kind of curious, and the mix of incomes in this project, I love all of that. Who went? I don't even know. Did anybody from city council go with you?
We had Councilman Wiggins and Councilman Broughton were there.
Oh,
as
great.
Well as we had a great group.
It's like 40 people, right?
We got on the bus. To have 40 people, give or take, either ride over and, you know, to give a day ultimately to their community. You know, regardless of what happens, whether this is what happens to Baptist, whether we take the property or not, there's lots of what ifs, of course,
right,
this early in the game. But to have 40 people across all different parts and aspects of our community to be there and to give a day of their life to come see what right may look like for us, I think was really amazing. And so, what was really cool too is I've been over there before. I've met with the Bayou District folks a couple of times, and that this is why you do something like that. There are questions that I haven't asked, you know, that someone from a different perspective, whether it be where they grew up, how they grew up, or what they're doing now in their career, in their passion in life. They ask questions that we may not have asked, you know, and that's exactly why you engage folks like that, is to say, hey, you know, you lend us your brain power and your expertise about, you know, what this could be and what concerns you may have.
Right.
And so, I think it was really valuable in that sense.
And you know, you mentioned yesterday in the press conference, having such a diversity of viewpoint and experience and endeavor really is going to make sure that you bring all of the right elements of out of the presentation or out of the people who are available to answer those questions. So I totally agree with you on that way of approaching it. We always like to tomorrow night's city council meeting is going to be 8 minutes long. Well, I mean, other than public forum, which God only knows. You never know what's going to happen with public forum. Not a whole lot on the agenda tomorrow night, but, you know, as the agenda review showed, being, you know, other than the presentation, I think it was about 6 minutes long altogether. So I always like to end with a lightning round, something fun, fast, whatever. First question, is there, this week was, I think Monday, was National Snack Day. D.C. Reeves is snackety hungry in the afternoon. What is his go-to snack?
Unfortunately, a lot of times it's prioritizing whatever's available, which is not the best health habits. Don't do that, kids. But I would say
maybe ask it a different way. What little bag of food, when you see it available to you, like at a buffet or a party or a whatever, what's the one that gets you the most excited? You're like, oh, give me that. I got to have it.
Yeah, I mean, I would say some kind of chips. I mean, they're just easy. It's quick. You know, I like Doritos. I like Lay's. I like. But I thought I was going to give you sour candy. I mean, that's my go-to.
Okay, all right, I got you. Fair enough. When you are texting, you're younger. You know, you're younger. When you are texting, what level of grammar and punctuation do you engage in? Do you capitalize first letters? Do you use periods? Do you use commas?
This is a great question. I'm glad anybody who gets a text from me now can sympathize. It's not much, which is unfortunate. I was a journalist, and it's embarrassing to say. It's like no punctuation really at all, and it's usually because I'm moving fast, you know, and just wanting to buy.
Yep.
But I could see so the recipient being upset with me about, you know, being terse, which I really am not. I'm just trying to get it knocked out. You know? Very transactional.
One space or two after a sentence for you.
Oh, absolutely one. Actually, two kind of frustrates me. I don't know.
Okay.
We'll
try to keep working on a relationship.
It was someone else. Yeah.
last one for you. Name something that when you were a kid, you thought was going to be a big deal and you were going to have to worry about. And as an adult, turns out not to be that big of a deal. My favorite example of this is like quicksand. You know, I thought there was going to be quicksand everywhere based on TV.
Yeah.
And now it turns out not to be a big thing. So something that from your childhood you were worried about that turns out that's really not that problem, that much of a problem.
Quicksand's a great one, actually. That's a great example. Probably, alligators or sharks anytime I was ever swimming. I would think that would be that's my concern. You know, I hope that's not how I go now that I've said this on radio, but that's
Oh, well, we'll play it at the funeral. It'll be fine.
I would say that concern's been mitigated somewhat.
At D.C. Reeves, the mayor of Pensacola, as always, sir, thanks for the time, and we'll look forward to the meeting tomorrow night and then the interview next week. Thank you so much, sir. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right.